where does language fail us? Okay. Maybe I just give you some context as to why I asked you that question. First of all, you speak two languages. You speak three languages,
Four.
Okay, scratch that. She speaks four languages, ladies and gentlemen. So that's English, Japanese, Korean,
and Chinese.
And Chinese. Mandarin?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Even in the English language, there's always something that escapes us, right? And then we have to resort to other languages to help us out.
Right.
Things like Schadenfreude.
Right.
Right? Yeah. Or even the simple déjà vu.
Yeah.
So, is it similar for you where English kind of like stops working for you and then you have to dig into your Japanese or your Korean recesses and think?
Yes, I think for sure, because as you learn a new language, you realize it's not really just about the words, but it's about how they think. Because obviously, you know, language is a part of culture. And when I learned Japanese, it came to me that, wow, the Japanese think of ways to describe themselves, and you would realize that there's also, you know, it's common in other languages as well, but there's the female usage and then the male usage. So it's just a way of expression, I feel, and English is it's so basic lah to me. After you learn a new language, you realize there are a lot of things that you could have expressed in other languages that you can't with English. And so in other aspects of how language fails us is especially in art or music, you feel a certain way, but you just can't seem to express it in that particular language. Maybe there's something in French or in Japanese that you could have used, but I wouldn't have thought about it in English. So that, I guess, would be a limitation in how I think if I only knew one language. So that's how I would see how language would fail us if we only know that. So for example, like even just in Mandarin Chinese, the 成语, right? Well, things that you have to maybe use a sentence or two to express in English, you could have said it in four words. So that's something that's quite interesting to me. I mean...
Just for the benefit of listeners who might not understand what the 成语 is, it's basically these four-word idioms.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And then it's packed with meaning, layered with context and everything else.
Every word means something.
Exactly. Yeah. And then the whole thing means something complete. It describes an entire situation,
exactly.
Basically.
Yes, yeah. And I've come to appreciate that because it's like so little can mean so much.
Yes.
Right? So an example, again, is that I always think about it in my work now, is that term 化蛇添足, right?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I was thinking exactly the same thing.
Yeah. So like in the past, I wouldn't have thought, you know, people would just say less is more, you know, but you don't really understand what that means. But so 化蛇添足, I mean, for people who may not understand, it's like really adding legs to a snake, right? And I used to be like, oh, that's funny, you know, I still think it's a funny image. But then now you grow up, you start to realize, wow, that image of somebody drawing that snake and then adding the legs.
And then there was a story behind it as well. Remember, there was a drawing competition, essentially.
Yes.
And this dude, he drew his snake.
Yes.
He finished it way ahead of time.
Yeah.
Sat there twiddling his thumbs and said, oh, what else can I do?
Yes.
Ah, I'll add legs
and
to the snake.
Ruined,
and he ruined his picture.
Yeah, so I think that's really common in, like, for people who are doing, like, creating their own work, or they're doing some kind of creation, and you know, you always sit there because you're brainstorming. I think it applies to most of the things that we do, actually, even if it's not art, even if it's not music. It's like you're sitting there, and you're like, okay, I want to impress somebody, right? I'm thinking, this is not much, maybe I should do something more, and then you overdo it, and then people are just like, nah, this is just contrived, you know. And I face that a lot in my work, and now I kind of use that 成语, you know, the idiom, to remind myself, okay, this is done, this is enough.
So you have to very consciously stop yourself.
Yeah, so sometimes I don't, and I try, I'm like, ah, why did I do that? Like, that brushstroke was unnecessary, you know, that sort of thing. So, I mean, I at the start, it used to be just experimentation. I would just be like, okay, you know, let's see where this takes us. And it wasn't so much about completing it in the aesthetic form. It was just really, how much can I do with the technique? Then only after that, I start thinking, okay, how nice it would be to just, you know, look at it and say, wow, this is really complex, but it looks so simple. Mm. Yeah, and that's something that I'm trying to achieve with my work. And I think I wouldn't have thought about that.
Is there an equivalent in Japanese? But
there are other things that really also draw that out. I mean, this word has been overused, I'm sure, but it's also very important, called wabi-sabi. If you ask a Japanese, they can't explain it because it's a feeling. Like when you look at it, you know it is. It gives that vibe. So they can't explain it, but if you look into, because I used to search Wikipedia, what is wabi-sabi? They tell you it's the art of perfection. And it's really something that, it's part of their philosophy, because they have this Buddhism and they learn it in Zen. So wabi-sabi came about from that concept. So it's really, you know, working with a piece, or even just working with your surroundings and going with nature. But what I hate about that term is because it kind of became quite a popular term for artists. And then sometimes when I'm working with my students and they're in the first class, then they ruin the piece because they're not good with it, you know. And then they say, it's okay lah, wabi-sabi. And I really... I just sit there and I'm just like, oh my god. But because it's your first class, I don't want to go into the details. You don't know what it means to say wabi-sabi.
Don't okay? anyhow yeah.
use. But I just like, okay, yes, but let's work on the second piece and do it better.
Wow, okay, so it's the art of perfection. Because
imperfection.
Imperfection. Yeah. Like kintsugi and all
yes,
that, is it?
Yes,
because,
yeah.
And then you've got loads of words for the word perfection also. There's
exactly.
kansei, there's
yes.
kanpeki.
Yes, that's right.
Kanzen.
Yes.
Banzen.
Yeah. and some words are used in different ways for, like, even
context.
Though they all mean, yeah, even if they all mean the same thing. So, again, that's pretty impressive to have in a language.
Yeah. So many ways of expressing perfection.
Yeah. Which is something, you know, in English, what is it? It's perfection. You use one word. So for the Japanese, they have these words that you can't really describe in other forms of language. And even today, like some of, because I, you know, it shouldn't be a conscious thing.
Right.
It should really be something that's a part of nature. So that's...
So would you consider this to be one of the untranslatable words
yes,
that can be communicated
definitely.
Through your art?
Yes, definitely. Not my art per se, but in some pieces of work that you might see quite often in Japanese art. Another term, maybe not as widely used, is shibui. So again, shibui is a term that is also in the same context of Buddhism. It came mm-hmm. from that, you know, that zenness, I guess. And it's often confused with wabi-sabi, because at the start I thought it was the same thing as well. Then when I asked my teachers, like, no, it's a different feeling. Again, another different kind of emotion, I guess, when you look at it. So wabi-sabi can be a deliberate, you know, way to work with imperfection. You know, masters become so good at it, they just flawlessly create, you know, the texture and all that. But, you know, make a dent or to make a statement out of that imperfection. But shibui is really much more on, in a way you can say, a fine line between simplicity and complexity, you know. Yeah, so it's really achieving that quiet complexity in their work. So it's not meant to purposely stand out. It's really more about, okay, I'm going to create many layers in my work, and it should look simple to the naked eye, but people who really know ceramics will see, wow, this guy made so much out of something so little. If anything, I think I strive to do that in my work more than this wabi-sabi concept. In many ways, I always try to, you know, I don't want things to look complicated, but I have many layerings that I want to achieve.
And certainly the process is not simple.
No, it's definitely there's a lot of things that you have to do at the start. Okay, in the forming of the work, how do I think about, you know, shaping, you know, and then I create textures maybe then. Then I improvise along the way with it. But even then, it's like, okay, as I'm doing the work, I don't think as deeply about I have to achieve this particular effect.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, okay, I've done this before. Okay, I'll play play around. But also, you know, with an aesthetic in mind, then I go around and I create layers as I work. So something that looks simple could be something that I've taken a month to think of and go along the way to create. Yeah.
Wow. So. But in addition to culture, I mean, how do space, architecture and culture affect, inspire you? What sort of impact do they have on you?
I mean, I could have traveled in certain places, but I don't know enough about it. But the places that I lived in, like in Japan and Korea, I've definitely, you know, immersed myself much more in the countryside. When I was doing my residency, I was also in the countryside. And
would you say that's the best place to be sometimes?
Yes.
I don't know, Laha, actually. There's much to be said about the urban landscape.
Yes, of course. I think architecture is definitely very interesting for me. I have a newfound love for architecture after I went for Tadao Ando's exhibition. So and I'm like, wow, that's really something that's also a bit like Shibui, you know, like you go in and it's like he just does it with glass and concrete, but you feel so much
in that.
You know, architecture. He plays around with nature, and his idea was never to stand out. He was always to, you know, I survey the landscape. How can I build something that blends with that nature? So I always felt like that's a really interesting way to work. You know, some people, I mean, of course, everyone has their own style of working. When they do it, they want it to stand out. It's like a sculpture in it. So, but for him, I learned a lot because he just works with that concrete. But when you look at the concrete, you realize that he has some form of technique to really refine that architecture.
What sort of techniques?
Yeah, so concrete, you see it everywhere, but his concrete is shaped and molded and casted very cleanly. You don't see as many cracks as you would see in other forms of concrete. And
how does he achieve that?
I don't know. It's like probably his secret, lah, you know,
the secret recipe.
Yeah, to why his concrete is so perfect, even though it's such a rough medium.
Mm-hmm.
So he's definitely done a lot of research, worked with a lot of very good you know, contractors to get that going for him. But that itself is like, to the naked eye, you're just like, okay, that's concrete. You know, the look is good, but you look closely, it's like there's so many layers to how he's achieved that layer of concrete. And so I find that very inspiring because even though it's not the same medium, the concept is that I resonate with is still there. And it motivates me to try to keep that going, you know. Keep it simple, but the technique is really strong. And what's your end goal with it?
Mm. And then culture, how does that come into play in addition to the whole language aspect and feeling and emotion?
Personally, I really like the Koreans because culture, I would say, is the interaction with the people. And I mean, I loved being with the Japanese as well, but I went in knowing that, okay, the Japanese have a very polite, they are very polite and courteous, and they have this need to be harmonious, you know, with who they are with. So, you know, some people, they say maybe it's a bit pretentious because they don't show what they really feel. The Koreans are kind of the opposite. So you would know if you went even to the train station, you get very pissed off because they just push you out. But what I really like about them is that once you get to know them, they're very genuine. And there's something, another word that you can't really translate in another, it's called chong, J-U-N-G, I guess if you type it in English. So chong in Hanzi, in Chinese, is actually qing. You know, that word itself is really to express that feeling of attachment they have to you. And so, you know, if you see maybe in some dramas, they call their older brothers oppa, older sisters onni. And you know, it's like they call you family even though you're not actually family.
Right.
And it really goes with friendship and all that. You know, you might know this person for a month, but because they call it chong terosso. That means like you've kind of got that emotion of attachment with this person, and you do a lot more for this, you feel a lot more for this friend. So I'd say, you know, that part of me has made me feel a sense of warmness, and I also really love to translate that in my work. And I feel like that's a very strong part of their culture. It's not spoken a lot, but you feel it. One more recent one would be Melbourne. I was there because my husband's family is based there. And so actually 2 years ago, I was there for, I think, 6 weeks, really just to be with his family. And I managed to join a ceramic studio. And the thing about it is I would have loved to go out, to have gone out of Melbourne, maybe to the more countryside areas, but I was stuck more in the city. So I went to a studio that was in the city. But when I just saw their work and, you know, just driving along the highway on the way to the studio, I realized the colors of Melbourne is so different. You know, that. So if you're talking about space again, mm-hmm. I realized, oh, you know, as compared to this tropical island Singapore, the colors in Melbourne, the trees, the even the earth, the colors are a lot muted as compared to a bright, you know, you would think Singapore is a lot brighter. Even the shade of green is not the same.
Right.
Right. So if you look at eucalyptus leaves versus like a palm leaf, the color is not the same. And I didn't think about that shade a lot until I went to Melbourne. And then I'm like, oh, actually, you know, these colors actually go really well. And I want to do that for a collection. So I went to the studio. I just stayed there for days. I created a collection. So it was called Sunset in Melbourne. That was in 2016 or 17. And I was just like, wow, really would have thought of colors like that for a collection. And the culture there is so laid back.
Right.
So when I was doing the pieces, I was just like, wow. You don't think about time at all, you know, like when you're in Singapore, because I guess the use of the studio is like 2.5 hours, 3 hours. Mm. But when I was there, you could use it for the whole day and they just charge you for the day. So, you know, my mindset became also very chill. It's like, okay, yeah, you know, I'm going to make a few pieces. If it don't work out, I'll restart again. No pressure, you know. And again, I think when I looked at my own work, I do see that there was that sense of, okay, every piece can be slowly made. You know, I don't want to rush it. Yeah, when I was in Singapore, it's just really like, okay, I only have 2.5 hours, I got to get 3 pieces done, you know. So not as much thought was put into it. So I guess that kind of started me on the journey of, okay, every piece should be better thought of. You know, take the time with each piece. What do I want to make out of that? Instead of quantity, you know.
But with those challenges of colours, or maybe the lack thereof, and certainly the lack of time, but plenty of stress. Mm. Why base yourself in Singapore?
Of course, family is the main reason. I was pretty much raised here. And you know, I definitely thought a lot about just working in Korea when I was there. But there are certain challenges that I find I can't surpass in the next 2 years. For example, even to find a job there, you need to take an exam, you know. But
a language proficiency exam?
Not just that. Korean history, politics.
Ah, okay.
They have like, you know, it's kind of similar to Japan actually. And that's why it's so hard to get employed these days, because the competition is so high and the exams are so hard. So,
and the exams are in Korean?
Yes, all in Korean. So they also have English exams, which I would have aced. But that's the only thing I'm probably going to be good at. That kind of made me question, okay, I could study for the next 2 years, but would I be as good as a native Korean? And, you know, I definitely want to have some work experience along the way. By then, you know, I can't just keep on studying. So I came back to Singapore and, of course, I met my boyfriend, now husband, and he's also based here. There's so much to explore because Singapore is such a young country. Mm. You could come out with start a community yourself. You could do something that builds on that. Whereas something as saturated as, say, Japan, where there are thousands of masters, you know, where do you come in? You know, you have to really... So there are different things that come into play when I think about where I want to be based in. If I want to be based in Japan, I wouldn't think of myself as, okay, I'm going to start my own space and work. I'll probably be learning under somebody and taking away what I can from that. But if I'm in Singapore, then I have to really establish something of my own as well. And, you know, I want to make something that I can truly call my own. And I think that's a lot easier in Singapore, contrary to popular belief when they say, you know, art is art alive in Singapore? You know, is there art in Singapore? But I think there are a lot of people, especially people my age, who are trying to work that.
So what is it about pottery and ceramics that so consumes you?
Quite interestingly, because when I started doing pottery, it was all about, okay, making the form, right? Making the shape and getting used to being on the wheel or with your hands. It's more like a craft, lah, so they say. But then as you go deeper into it, you realize that there's a lot of science involved in pottery that people don't see with the naked eye, right? You probably just look at the pot, so, oh, it's a pot. But how did we get to making that pot? There's a lot of science involved, a lot of chemistry, a lot of physics as well.
Right, I mean the kneading, the clay, the how long you fire,
exactly, the temperature, and then the chemistry really comes in the glazes, the type of clay that you use to go with the glaze. You know, a lot of testing is involved. It was always that interest in science that made me feel like there's so much more to pottery than in other forms. You know, like painting and all that. You know, okay, sure, maybe, you know, you could blend your own colours someday and all that. But, you know, if you wanted to go into making the paint one day, then the science comes in again. But a lot of pottery comes into, okay, it's not just a form. The form is nothing. It has to survive in the kiln, you know, and the colours have to match the clay you're using. Then when the piece comes out, you know, it's really a process. You can't just look at, okay, just make the form, that's it, you know. With paint, you could have just, okay, I'm going to paint and then I can buy the paint from an art shop, that's it. So it's really the aesthetic, but...
That's something you do in a two-hour workshop.
Exactly, yeah. So, but that's why I don't really do a one-day workshop for wheel throwing. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but it's just that personally, I would love for people to go through the entire process. So I do an introduction course, which is 4 weeks, once a week. So you do one thing in that 1 week. You learn how to make the form, you learn how to trim, you learn how to glaze. And then I tell you, you don't actually get to experience the kiln firing part, but I do tell you what goes on in there. So I feel that it's really important that you know how difficult the craft is. If you come in on a one-day trial, you can only make the form on the wheel, and then it's an ugly form. 80% of the work will be done by me. When you leave the 2 hour course, I'm behind the scenes trimming the piece for you, glazing the piece for you. When you come and collect it, you can't even recognize it's your work, you know? So that part about it, you know, the art and the science coming in together was really what drew me in. First of all, it was the obsession that I got to make this shape perfect, you know, the walls have to be straight. Then when I started to learn, how did these glazes come to be? You know, then I realized, wow, there's a lot of chemistry involved, a lot of raw materials that you have to blend, percentages come into play, recipes, tweaking them to make it your own. That's a whole other science, you know, and you take so much time just to get that right. Because after you get the glaze, you have to test it on a few types of clay. Okay, does the clay, that's the glaze, you know, kind of craze, you know, for example, the shrinkage doesn't match the clay. Then you have to revisit your recipe again. Something went wrong, you know, did I put too much of the flux in there? You know, flux is to lower the temperature of the silica, which is a glass former on the glaze. So then you have to look up, you know, go into ready-made glazes, see the percentage, compare, and then, you know, because I'm not a scientist to begin with, so I can't create it from scratch. What I do is I go from existing recipes, then I was like, okay, I got this look, but what if I made it a bit greener? What if I made it a bit bluer? So, you know, then I play with the colorants that I can add on to the glaze. And I'm like, only in that, maybe 1% done, you know, in this whole science and art of pottery. Yeah, so that drew me in.
Then there you will stay for a while,
yeah,
I think,
because
right?
You know, like, hey, wow, I did this one thing, but there's still 1,000 things I haven't done. So I slowly progress from there.
And so as you work your way to becoming Master Potter...
Oh, yes.
I'm absolutely sure you're going to get there, okay? Are you working on a signature?
I think I'm working on it because to create a signature takes time as well. I mean, even like you mentioned, Master Potter Iskandar Jalil, you can look at his pot and definitely know that it's his.
What gives it away?
Several things. The way he creates the textures, the colour. If you follow his work, there's a very prominent glaze that he uses called, which I think some people have dubbed it Iskandar Blue. It's a very bright blue, almost turquoise kind of glaze, and that gives it away for sure, because no one has that kind of blue like him, because he kind of tweaked it to his own recipe. So even though I've spoken to him and I've kind of learned from him, but I also don't want to be associated, because it's not me, right? And at the end of the day, he always says, you know, to all his students and people who come, you know, what is your pop? You know, the words that he's told me that I really carry with weight is, anyone can make a pot, but will you be able to make a good pot that's yours? So obviously I'm still quite young. I wouldn't say that I've made a pot that I can really say is me, you know, but I think I put out works that I can really say that, okay, I worked very hard to create an effect. I'm happy with it. I'm going to put it out. So I'm still working on that signature. I don't consciously think about it, because again, it comes to you with the practice, comes to you with what you like, and then what you're aiming to achieve, right? Everyone has something that they want to achieve in their work. So if I've really succeeded in doing that, then I would say, yes, this is my work. I'm inspired by different things and I create different things. But I think there's some kind of muscle memory, there's some kind of, you know, something that you're used to that will become your signature over the years. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that will come.
But where can people find your stuff then, if they wanted to purchase?
So now I'm working with Knuckles and Knot. My older works are still in Gallery and Co. The older works are a lot more functional, like they're just more clean. But I'd say like that was still a process that I was working on, and I'm happy with it, so I put it out. Most of them are offline commissions.
Okay.
Yeah, they come to me personally and tell me, oh, I want a teapot set, or like, you know, they tell me, oh, I want a series done by you. So then I can do it behind the scenes, off the retail rack for them. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
No, thank you so much.
This has been Mackerel Moments. You can read and listen to more of our stories on our website, mackerel.life. Until next time, thanks for listening.